All right, thank you once again for returning for our afternoon sessions. This particular lecture will be concerning Robert Louis Dabney. I've entitled it The Cassandra of Yankeedom. I'll explain what I mean by that. My thanks for the introduction to this lecture. My thanks go to Pastor David Coffin, who gave a wonderful lecture on Robert Louis Dabney a number of years ago in Virginia, a lecture that I heard and copied down, and I give him the kudos for some of what I'm going to say in my introduction. One of my purposes in telling you about Robert Louis Dabney in the sense that I'm going to discuss him is because he's a forgotten man, and that I want you to get a flavor for how important he really was in his day, and maybe a sense of how important he could be today, that he still speaks to us in various ways. It is an enormous privilege to be able to talk to you about Robert Louis Dabney, but it is a bit daunting. And Mr. Coffin said that it was like a kitten coming to tell you about how great a lion is. It's even a greater gap from me to Robert Louis Dabney than he was. It was extraordinary that one would even have to sing his praises, since he is manifestly one of the greatest gifts to the church that the Lord has ever presented in America. He was one of the greatest exponents and defenders of the historic theology of the Reformation, certainly in the 19th century and perhaps any century. Such a statement today might be easily dismissed as brash and ill-considered, but it once commanded common consent among those best suited to judge it. A.A. Hodge of Princeton said Dabney was, quote, the profoundest thinker on theological subjects, in my judgment, that America has produced. In the estimation of Benjamin Warfield, we hear that Dr. Dabney was not only an influential statesman and powerful ecclesiastical force, but, quote, an acute philosophizer and a profound theologian, but a devoted Christian, which is best of all. Warfield praised Dabney's powerful advocacy of the truth that was for him life itself. A reviewer of his public lectures on systematic theology concluded, quote, Dr. Dabney had the eminent privilege and honor to rearticulate the ancient Calvinism in modern forms of scientific thought, and he has done his work well. Upon his death, Dabney was memorialized in the New York Evangelical, or the New York Evangelist, as the, quote, the foremost scholar and polemic in all the South, without doubt one of our greatest writers and teachers. P.P. Formeray, co-laborer in the pastorate from Bethesda, Maryland, acknowledged, quote, Dr. Dabney has been recognized for a generation past, in some respects, as the first preacher of the Presbyterian Church. His position, too, as a theologian is unquestioned. He certainly stands among the first that our country has produced, and in the opinion of many, he holds the first place. Dr. Moses Hoag, speaking at Dabney's funeral, declared, no church on this continent has been more favored of heaven than our own, in having at its organization three such men as Thornwell, Palmer, and Dabney, each fitted by a splendid genius and a profound scholarship, a life consecrated to the noblest uses, to give direction to its future life, to enrich for all time by their publications in their theological sciences. Thomas Carey Johnson, a student of Robert Louis Dabney, and later his biographer, said this, Dr. Dabney was a great man. We cannot just tell how great. One cannot see how tall Mount Blanc is while standing at its foot. Over 100 years from now, men will be able to see him better. One of Dabney's students put it this way. Dabney, he said, as a philosopher, was so preeminent that it's safe to say he will appear larger to men 100 years from now than he did to his contemporaries. Unfortunately, his student could not have been more wrong in his prognostications. He was unduly optimistic about the safety of his projection. Johnson would be mortified to find that in 100 years, The mountain would, in many ways, have become a molehill. In 1994, Dabney was virtually unknown in the history of American philosophy and hardly rated as a footnote in the annals of American theology. Today, there is no book-length study of Dabney's contribution, and only a handful of doctoral dissertations have taken his life and thought worthy of consideration. Studies in academic journals are rare, and his literary remains are either lost or hardly known, even among those who follow in the same tradition. The American Reformed community ought to be ashamed that Dabney's writings have been kept in print by a British publisher, Banner of Truth, except for Brother Lloyd Sprinkle up there in Harrisonburg, who has seen to it that at least some American representation is in the field of Dabney studies. It is ironic in some ways, perhaps, that the Banner of Truth refused to publish Volume 4 of his collected writings. And that's going to be the subject of my little talk today, will be some of the content from Volume 4 of his discussions. Better make sure it's Volume 4. Yes, it is. And it was the volume that was entitled Secular, which is perhaps a poor way to render what they were called, but that's what they were when they were published. They were called his secular, quote, secular writings, and the British publisher apparently is extremely embarrassed by Dabney's patriotism, Southern patriotism, and Confederate sentiments, and won't reprint Volume 4, but Lloyd Sprinkle has reprinted it, and we sell it here. Not like hotcakes yet, but perhaps someday. We want to consider something of Dabney, though he is neglected today. That neglect is not grounded in the merits of the question. It certainly becomes a people to recognize heroic figures of the past, that their own hearts and minds might be stirred in their own day to preserve, to serve well. Believers in particular are called to remember their leaders and to emulate their faith. For the Lord Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever. That same Lord may well be pleased to use us after this fashion, after the fashion of our fathers. John Gerstner used to say that according to the Apostle Paul, there weren't many of the wise and able in the world that God was going to put these to shame by calling those who were not, and so on. But he said that every once in a while in the history of the church, God would really create a first order intellect and devote that intellect to the cause of the gospel just to prove there was nothing at all with respect to the gospel that would diminish the finest human mind possible. St. Augustine, John Calvin, certainly Jonathan Edwards. And among those demonstration projects from time to time, certainly Robert Louis Dabney fits into that category. A man of extraordinary ability devoted to the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. Dabney was born March the 5th, 1820, in Louisa County, Virginia. And his Virginia roots were deep, and they were wide, and they never left him, never left his mind, never left his interest. He came from French Huguenot stock via England. His forebears were able, both in politics and in business. He was a product of the antebellum South, antebellum Virginia civilization. Hospitality was a cardinal virtue. They were devoted to wide-ranging conversation. Family was of preeminent importance. They were self-reliant, intensely patriotic, and active in politics. A keen sense of honor, committed to education, a reading people, loving books and writing letters. Dabney was the product of this civilization. He began schooling in 1827 under his brother Charles, and they then moved from their original home along the South Anna River to a larger one near Club Creek in Louisa County. The home is gone today. It lay somewhere between Louisa Courthouse and Richmond, but there's a family graveyard and a big field there near Louisa Courthouse, and you can visit the family cemetery. Dabney's father died in 1833 when Dabney was just 13 years old. That put the family fortunes in the hands of his mother and the children as they aided her. He was taught in a variety of ways in his early schooling. A particularly influential person in his education was the Reverend James Wherry, pastor of Providence Presbyterian Church that his family attended. That church is still an active congregation today. It was founded originally by Samuel Davies, the apostle to Virginia, and Dabney was a product of his family. The Reverend Wary had a tremendous interest in church history, and he published a little book entitled Sketches in Church History that the Presbyterian Board put out in 1840. It may very well be that it was there that Dabney came to have his special interest in the history of the church. In 1836, Dabney entered Hampden-Sidney College at 16 years of age. Hampden-Sidney is on the south side of Virginia near Farmville, near the town of Farmville, and it was Presbyterian, and it was named after two great English patriots. He studied math, physics, chemistry, metaphysics, moral philosophy, Latin and Greek, and he aspired to become a learned man. He also, at that time, took up his writing career. 10 papers survive from this period. A number of those are housed in the rare book room at Union Theological Seminary in Richmond, Virginia. But the most important item of this period at Hampden-Sidney was his conversion, as he marked it. The college was visited in 1836 with a very powerful and genuine spiritual awakening. This was the most important time in his life as he came to make a profession of faith. Later in the fall, he joined and became a communicant member at Providence Church, where the church where his father had served as an elder. During this period also, there was an enormous controversy in the Presbyterian Church. 1837, the old school and new school division took place. Dabney was a distant observer here, though it rocked both the college and the seminary as they were divided over the questions that had troubled the Presbyterian Church. In 1837, he left college to help his mother on the farm. He actually did love farming, but he took up the work of a school teacher to put food on the table for his family. Working as a farmer between terms was useful in helping the other young boys prepare for college. Dabney forever enjoyed planting and making things grow. He is going to become what today would be called a polymath. He was an authority and an expert in a lot of different areas, as Jonathan Edwards was, and John Calvin too. He had an inquiring mind that peered into every area of knowledge that came his way. He had some particular interests that he honed over the years: architecture, building buildings, farming, growing various and sundry things. Through the largesse of a family member, he was able in 1839 to enter the University of Virginia, which was not too far from Louisa County. There he had the opportunity to have an education from one of the finest academic institutions in the land, as you know, founded by Thomas Jefferson. There he studied physics and chemistry, mathematics and Latin, political economy, Greek, French, and Italian. He began his formal publishing career while there in the college magazine. His first article was The Superiority of Modern Over Ancient Literature, which sounds very undabney-like. But anybody who comes to know Dabney will realize that he did change his mind about that and always preferred the ancient over the modern. It's interesting that on the back of the manuscript of this little article, he wrote in a hasty scrawl, an abortion. That first article he wrote, he thought, later years was horrible. It was clear that Dabney changed his mind. He also wrote about the grounds at the University of Virginia, a very interesting little essay. He wrote, "What should be the atmosphere for the pursuit of the knowledge of God's world? When God was creating a campus for the study of his world for his first creature, Adam, what did he do? He put him in a garden. And he said he ought to be, and he said, this ought to be the proper framework for academic enterprise, a garden." Dabney always liked that setting. He urged the University of Virginia to become Eden-like, though if you know anything about that university, it doesn't have any characteristics of Eden other than the fall of man today. He also began to evidence the extraordinary character, the gift he had of satire and sarcasm, and that's going to come out in some of the things I'm going to read to you from Dabney today. You see, he had a very powerful gift. And it's the kind of thing that, if it's not brought under control, can do a lot of damage. Damage that it ought to do in the proper place, and no, do no harm beyond that, but sometimes it got out of hand. So as a critic of culture, as a cultural commentator, sometimes he would get a little bit over the top with his sarcasm and satire, and it is beautiful to behold. Well, he wrote one highly ironic essay about his experience in college life and wanted to record the results of his observations to instruct those who would come after him. He pointed out the very first thing you learn on campus is that college life should properly be regarded as a state of war against the faculty, who are your natural enemies. In 1842, he graduated with a master's degree, age 22. He would later say, "I confess that if I ever had any special intellectual growth and vigor, I owe it to three things. The Master of Arts course at the University of Virginia was one of those things. Also, a professor at Union Seminary, Dr. Sampson, and thirdly, the great Reformed scholastic Turretin, the three greatest influences on his intellectual life." He left University of Virginia to go back to farming and teaching in a classical school, but by 1844, he went on to pick up training for the work of the gospel ministry at Union Theological Seminary. And there he did just that. He began his preaching career in July of 1845, and he was called to be the pastor of the Tinkling Springs Presbyterian Church in Augusta County, Virginia. That church is still there. I don't remember the pastor's name today, but her name might come to me a little bit later. I can't remember. But there he met his wife. Also, one of the great things that happened to him while he was pastor of that church is he met 18-year-old Lavinia Morrison, the preacher's daughter, a preacher's daughter. And as Dabney tells it, it was love at first sight. This was the golden age of his life as in his first pastorate, falling in love. His family criticized him for precipitous pursuit of this young woman. He was told he did not understand women's entangling ways. But he claimed that her character and charm and beauty would win over his relatives and hers. And he was able to convince her father, the important thing. And he and Lavinia were married with everybody's approval in the end. He was called to Union Seminary in 1854, having spent, I think it was about 7 years as pastor at Tinkling Springs. So he had the practical ministry of being out there in the war. And then off he went, I say at the war, but the spiritual wars of being a pastor and the experience of expounding the Word of God every week and counseling and all the things that pastors do. It's 7 years of experience, but then he was called to Hampton, Sydney, to the seminary, which had fallen on very hard times. They only had a handful of students when he arrived there, 11 students, and a very low morale. Seemed like the place was in his death throes when Robert Louis Dabney arrived. He taught ecclesiastical history and polity, and he believed very strongly in a Southern education for Southern men, for Southern pulpits. He thought all young men who wanted to enter the ministry should come to Hampton, Sydney and not go to Princeton. But still, a goodly number did go to Princeton. In fact, during his seminary years, he taught 465 students. He trained 465 men for the gospel ministry. At the same time, the Hodges at Princeton trained over 1,500, almost 1,600 men, which included 150 Southerners. And there was a little bit of rivalry there between the Northern Seminary and the Southern. But Dabney believed that Southern men should have Southern training for their pulpits. He wrote for and edited the Central Presbyterian. He was old school Presbyterian all the way. He built the college church, which would seat 800. And he was a regular commissioner to the General Assembly. He became a very well-known man in the denomination. During this period, his two oldest boys died of diphtheria just a couple months apart, which was a terrible, terrible grief to him. His other sons, though, over time, he had three more sons, one of which died of diphtheria. Actually, four sons. And three grew to adulthood. One became a university president, and two of them became attorneys in Texas. And I met one time, I met one of the Dabney's grandsons from one of the attorneys in Texas. Princeton tried to get him to come there several times, and he turned them down each time. He just believed that he belonged in the South with his people. From 1860 to 1865 came the war between the states, and Robert Louis Dabney's student body, many of them enlisted, most of them enlisted in the Army, and they formed a company that became part of the 18th Virginia Infantry. If any of you watched the film last night of Gettysburg, the 18th Virginia was right at the apex of Pickett's charge as they crossed the high water mark in front of the grove of trees. And that particular regiment still had a few boys in it from the seminary at Hampton, Sydney. And he went to war with them as the chaplain of that regiment. And they were early on in the war. As soon as Virginia seceded, they formed up and were assigned and were at the Battle of First Manassas. And there, as a chaplain, Dabney was able to minister to the soldiers in the Army, but even perhaps more importantly, at the time, he met Stonewall Jackson. And Jackson already was an admirer of Dabney, and then Dabney showed up on the battlefield. Dabney was older, of course, than Jackson, but not by a lot. Dabney was an opponent of secession and an opponent of war. And he prayed and he wrote and he argued to keep the country from going to war. In fact, one of the articles that he wrote was published nationally by the Presbyterian Church, North and South. And it was an appeal to maintain their oneness in Christ and to dampen down the ardor for warfare. And it didn't work out. And so to war he went himself. In April of 1862, Stonewall Jackson wrote Dabney and asked him to come to the Shenandoah Valley to be his adjutant general, that is, his personal secretary, as it were. Dabney said, "No, I can't do that. I really don't know anything about playing army." And Jackson said, "We'll teach you what you need to know. We know that you know how to write. And all you have to do is take the orders that I tell you and write them down. That's what you're going to do. As well as have theological discussions every night in my tent and conduct Bible studies for my staff and all of that." So Dabney finally was persuaded, and he didn't get along too well at the beginning with Jackson's staff. He showed up in a black suit with an umbrella over his shoulder riding something that looked like a mule. And Jackson's staff was young, and they all got a big charge out of the preacher that suddenly showed up to be Jackson's right-hand man. As one staff member put it, he was too old, too reverend, too unelastic to fit into such a crowd, because Jackson's staff were lighthearted men. They were serious men, but they enjoyed themselves as young men will, and Jackson considered them frivolous, and they considered him too stiff. And after a while, one of his aides said, Dabney said that Jackson's aides were, quote, too bumptious and self-sufficient. And one of them said, "Our parson is not afraid of Yankee bullets, and I tell you, he preaches like the devil." So Jackson loved that. Jackson loved that. And Dabney was fearless, or very nearly so. There are a couple of humorous incidents of being under fire. But he was with Jackson by his side throughout the Valley Campaign and then throughout the Peninsula Campaign in 1862. And then he contracted what was called euphemistically camp fever, a fairly virulent form of diarrhea from which many men died. And Dabney was older than everybody else. He was 40 years old. He was ancient in that encampment. And he finally had to retire He had to resign his commission as a major, and he retired back to his teaching at Hampton, Sydney. Dabney never got over the war and never understood those who reconciled with the Yankees. He wrote several books. One was the authorized biography of Stonewall Jackson, because Lavinia, his wife, was the first cousin of Jackson's first wife, or Jackson's second wife, rather, Marianna Morrison. And so when Jackson went off to war, he sent his wife down to Hampton, Sydney to live with her cousin and live with the Jacksons. I mean, live with the Dabneys. And after Jackson was killed at Chancellorsville, Lavinia asked Dabney to write the official biography of her husband. And so she turned many of his papers and things over to Dabney, and he wrote the very first biography of Stonewall Jackson. And it's an intimate biography because he was with him through two campaigns and knew him so well. It has historical errors in it because, standing back years later, looking back at what actually happened, Dabney only saw what he saw and wrote it down, and sometimes he wasn't exactly right. But it's a very fine biography, and every biographer of Stonewall Jackson ever since has had to come to terms with Dabney and has had to use Dabney, because that's the greatest first-person original source regarding Stonewall Jackson, apart from Jackson's wife, who also, at the end of the century, wrote a memoir. Well, he also wrote a little book called A Defense of Virginia and Through Her of the South, which is what I call a biblical apologetic for slavery. And Dabney was known for that. He became well known for that. And today, if you even mention Dabney's name among scholars of the Civil War period, or scholars that study the culture of the period, they immediately call you a racist for even reading Dabney or thinking about him in any way, because he wrote this biblical apologetic for slavery, which actually was echoed almost line for line in the DVD we watched this morning. An interesting analysis of the times. Before the war, Robert Louis Dabney was a Virginian first and an American second. When the war was over, he was a Virginian first, a Southerner second, and an American maybe. He almost left the country. He wanted to join the Confederados in Brazil. He didn't think he could live under Yankee domination, and he was a bitter foe of accommodation and consolidation with the Northern Church as a result. He was unconquered, unconquerable, and forever alienated from the North. That includes his Northern brethren. He did not emigrate, however, and he was talked out of it. And for the next 20-some years, he taught at Hampton, Sydney, and was a stalwart and a central figure in the Southern Presbyterian Church. But what I want to take a look at in the time we have remaining is Robert Louis Dabney as the Cassandra of Yankeedom. Now, he wrote a marvelous systematic theology. He wrote a little book called Christ Our Penal Substitute, which is very fine. He wrote a book on Calvinism. He wrote many, many things of a theological nature. He was a poet. He wrote a fairly large number of poems, but many of those were related to the war. I mean, he has a poem about John Bell Hood and the Texas Brigade. He has poems about Stonewall Jackson, poems about Robert E. Lee. But he was a poet of some fashion, and certainly a theological tour de force in Southern Presbyterianism, not just his books, but his articles and his editings and that sort of thing. But the other thing that Dabney was, that a lot of other Southern Presbyterian preachers were not, is that he was a keen analyst of modern culture, the modern culture of his day. And in some ways, he was an absolute prognosticator of what was going to happen in America as a result of what was happening in his own day. When I call him the Cassandra of Yankeedom, Yankeedom is one of his words, Cassandra comes from Greek mythology. She was the daughter of King Priam and Queen Hecuba of Troy, and she had the power of prophecy and the curse of never being believed. A typical Greek goddess, flawed, has certain superpowers, but somehow they don't always work. In fact, they never do for Cassandra. I won't go through how they invented her, you know, the mythologies they grew up around her. But the point is that she was a curse was placed on her by somebody, Apollo, let's say. But the curse was that her predictions and those of all her descendants would not be believed. And so was Robert Louis Dabney. He prophesied all kinds of future things. He prophesied all sorts of, he did all sorts of cultural analysis and wrote articles and was a controversialist. And this is something that most pastors try to shy away from. But not Robert Louis Dabney. The man had a keen understanding of the times in which he lived. He was a son of Issachar. And he couldn't sit idly by and see heresy be rooted in the church or damage the church or lead the church astray. And he couldn't sit idly by and see the prevailing ideas and evils of his day be affixed to his beloved Virginia and beloved South. And of course, when you read Dabney, you have to understand all the evils in the world that he was observing, they all go back to Yankeedom. I mean, they're all things that came from the North and came as a result of the Civil War, and that they all came about as a result of oppression and the domineering influences of the Reconstruction period. So in the 1870s and 1880s, he wrote a number of terrific essays and had a number of controversies with liberal intellectuals of his day, and not a few conservatives, too. And what characterizes Dabney's taking on these particular monolithic ideas that were changing American culture is that he was unblinking in his confronting the enemy, and he was biblical in his presuppositions as how they ought to be analyzed and how it ought to be communicated to the church. And on top of that, some of that wit and sarcasm sometimes comes out page after page. And that has disturbed conservatives in his own day, because he wasn't nice to barbarians that were trying to wreck the country or wreck the culture or wreck the church. He took them on their own terms, on their own soil. He was much admired by those who were in agreement with him and much vilified and hated by those who weren't. And today, looking back, you say, oh, a pastor could not say things that way today. That's okay. Pastors couldn't say things that way then either, but he did it anyway. And he was a brilliant, formidable debater. And he was a philosopher. I mean, he was a serious philosopher and an expert in philosophy, as well as especially theology and biblical thinking. And I want to touch on maybe three things. If I've got the time to get through all three of them, maybe I can go kind of fast. I'll just pick and choose a few things, a few quotes and a few ideas of things that he took on. One of the biggest foes that he saw out there, they weren't on the horizon anymore. They had come to Virginia, and they were being forced on the people of Virginia. And the first big one that came down the pike following the war itself was public education. Statist public education. Now, we have a tendency to think that my generation does, of Christians, that when we were growing up, our public schools were pretty good. And by that we mean people didn't kill each other in the hallways. And we didn't have to go through metal detectors. And everybody wasn't on drugs, although some people were. And our teachers were strict, and they had discipline. So for Robert Louis Stabney, that's not related to education, really. It's the content. It's the presuppositions of the teaching. It's the presuppositions that the state is going to dictate what they call truth. And let me just read to you some of the contentions that Dabney had with the affixing of the government school on the state of Virginia. In 1876, he took on Dr. Ruffner, who was the leader of the state, what was called free school movement in Virginia. And the article by Dr. Dabney has this subheading: Dr. Dabney has a few words to say in reply to Dr. Ruffner. Writing from Hampton, Sydney, on April the 18th, 1876, he says this, because Dr. Ruffner was talking about free schools, and by that he meant state-supported, taxpayer-supported public schools. They were called free schools. And until that time, until Reconstruction, Virginia had, well, everybody was homeschooled or privately schooled, with Christian education primarily. He says, you think it inconsistent in me to disapprove any free school because you say I'm a professor in a free school. See, he's at Hampton, Sydney. A theological seminary. Well, this seminary is a free school. I thank the Jew for that word. Founded and sustained by the spontaneous, unforced gifts of good men, it gives free tuition in divinity to young men of all denominations, even the most opposed to the donors seeking the ministry. It is honestly and really a free school, supported by free gifts, attended by free voluntary pupils. No penny of the salary of its teachers is exacted by the tax gatherers from unwilling hands to pay for a project or an inculcation which they disapprove. Your free schools, like not a few of the other pretensions of radicalism, are in fact exactly the opposite to the name falsely assumed. The great bulk of those who pay the money for them do it not freely, but by compulsion, that is, taxes. They are virtually thrust down our throats by the bayonet. And the exemplars you most boast and imitate not only make the payment compulsory, but the attendance. The only freedom of your system is your freedom to compel other people's money. Okay, well, he's throwing down the gauntlet to public education at its beginning at the financial roots. And it's not free education. People are being robbed by the government, and their money's unwillingly being given to people that they don't approve of, teaching other people's children. Notwithstanding your glorying, then, I mean once more to assert the unfashionable truth. And to him, truth is never out of date or unfashionable. And that's what he does. We begin by reasserting the familiar objection so often contemptuously dismissed that the principle upon which the state intrudes into the parental obligation and function of educating all children is dangerous and agrarian. It is the teaching of the Bible and its sound political ethics that the education of children belongs to the sphere of the family, and that is the duty of the parents. The theory that the children of the Commonwealth are the charge of the Commonwealth is a pagan one, derived from the heathen Sparta and Plato's heathen Republic, and connected by regular logical sequence with legalized prostitution and the dissolution of the conjugal tie. The dispensation of divine providence determines the social grade and the culture of children on their reaching adult age by the diligence and faithfulness of their parents, just as the pecuniary condition of children at that epoch is determined. The desire of procuring for their children a desirable condition in all these respects is the grand stimulus which providence has provided for the efforts of parents. And then he says, the morality of the citizens is far more essential to the welfare of the state, and the only effectual basis for morals is the Christian religion. Therefore, the state could not be yet more bound to take order than all youth be taught Christianity. And then he goes on to say that we often hear this apology for the state's wholesale intrusion into education advanced with the exactness of a commercial transaction. They say it costs less money to build schoolhouses than jails. Have you ever heard that? I've heard that one. But what if it turns out that the state's expenditure in schoolhouses is one of the things which necessitates the expenditure in jails? He's also formidable in logic, and he presses his opponents back on their presuppositions. And then he goes on to cite the schools in Prussia for where this idea of the state school comes from, and the schools in France. All such promiscuous efforts to educate the whole masses by any secular authority must disappoint our hopes and result in mischief. True education, taken in any extent of its meaning, broad or narrow, is so greatly a moral process that a certain amount of aspiration and desire in its subject is an absolute prerequisite. So all education is moral, because the argument was being made by the state that they would leave religion out of it so nobody would be offended. And Dabney argues that all education is moral in its very essence. That's the argument Rushdoony makes as well in all of his writing on education, is that there aren't neutral facts and that all education is moral and has to do with theology and ethics. And the state is incompetent to communicate those things. Dabney also cites elsewhere in another letter to Dr. Ruffner. These were published in the papers, so the debate was carried on in print. But he cites the colonial schools in Connecticut. Well, they were all Christian schools. They were all run by the churches. So this is not the case here. This has nothing to do with what we're talking about here. This is an atheistic government imposing their values and their morals, and he would say immoralities, on the children of Virginia, and taking the money from unwilling parents to do so. So you can see his argument against public education is virulent and profound, and he wrote a lot about it. He says, if a system of universal common schools is to be carried out in good faith, there must be a mixture of the children of the decent and the children of the vile in the same society during their most plastic age. All the moral lepers among the children of a given district must be thrust into the society of our children at school in order to receive the shallow modicum of letters there dispensed. He calls it an obscenity, and the profanity and the groveling sentiments of the masses of people that will be compelled to mix all of their children. You don't want your children being educated by the pagan children, and the state's going to force you to do it. And so his opposition to free public schools made him a name, but it also made him absolutely hated by the professional educationists of his day. And there are all kinds of arguments that were made against him on that score, and he had an answer for every single one that went back to Scripture and logic, and what we would call today would be called family values, so scorned in the public square. In his most famous article on education, entitled "A Secularized Education," he says this: who's the agent entitled to control education? What is right education? Liberalism says the state, and insists on secularizing education, by which it means its release from the control of popery. Liberals see clearly that under that control, there will be no true freedom. But as they also insist on secularizing the state, their idea of a free education is one devoid of religion, separating the mental from the spiritual culture. The education must be godless in order to be free. Rome has herself to blame for this. He blames the Roman Catholic Church for that. and their arguments for educational freedom in the public square. And he says, the mistake is in confounding ecclesiastical with Christian education. Christian education is not the same as Roman Catholic education. That's ecclesiastical. We're talking about biblical education here. And the role of the state has nothing to play in that. Well, I could go on. I recommend to you the rest of his articles and letters on secularized education and public education. And he always makes predictions as to what will happen if this is affixed to Virginia or the whole nation. And every single thing he says, every single thing he predicted absolutely happened. And some of it took 100 years because he's just in one small corner of the country. But as we know, statist education has overwhelmingly taken control in every state in the nation. And Dabney said, here's what will happen when you separate true education from morals and from biblical teaching. And he was right. So I recommend to you Dabney's writings on secular education. Don't be put off by his, in reading things like that, don't be put off by Dabney's discussions and inclusion of his views of educating the freeman. As you know, the Civil War ended slavery, and there were suddenly millions of freemen in the South, uneducated. And the Northeastern schoolmarms and their political supporters flooded into the South to teach the slaves. But in order to do it, they did it through the state, and they did it through taxation. So when Dabney is looking at what the government is doing, a lot of times the government affixed their statist views through the avenue of helping the freedmen, helping the former slaves become educated. So don't be put off by Dabney's linking the education of freemen with the theories behind statist education. That was the vehicle the state used to affix a secularized, pagan, anti-Christian educational system. And he saw it all coming. Most people in the country, including Christians, they didn't know John Dewey yet. They didn't know those Prussians, anything about the Prussian schools in Europe. But when Dabney saw what was happening in Europe, and then he saw what the state was doing here during Reconstruction primarily, and that was written right at the end of Reconstruction. So he saw what the federal government was trying to affix to the states. This is in 1876. So those of you parents who are a little older and say, oh, you know, my education was pretty good when I was young in the public school, you better think again, because it's not what you think. Because your classmates weren't blowing each other up doesn't mean that you were in a good school. But Dabney gets to the heart of that. The nature of true education is moral and is the responsibility of parents. And by that, he did not mean that that parents only homeschooled their children, and if they didn't do that, they were violating biblical law or something along that line. He was just saying the parents are responsible. And he did support, you know, Christian education in all of its forms. But in this case, he was opposing the affixing of statist, pagan, secularized education. All right, let me shift gears real quick from education. This one may not seem as relevant, but it is definitely relevant and interesting, and that is Robert Louis Dabney took on the labor unions. And we don't have time to go into the history of organized labor in this country and all of that broad and bloody ground of the late 19th century. But Dabney, just sitting back and seeing the labor unrest, the blowing up of policemen with dynamite in Chicago, at the Haymarket riot, the riots in Pittsburgh, the slaughters of police and organized labor people and people that were trying to get jobs, etc. Standing back and watching all of that happening and reading and studying and knowing what the labor, organized labor leaders were trying to accomplish, then he took on that subject. He wrote an article, an essay, published in the Texas Review in 1891. So the organized labor movement was 12, 15 years old, and he saw what it did. He said, they define themselves as the voluntary societies of working men for protecting the rights of labor. And he said, their actual true purpose, after seeing how that worked out in practice, he said, is to control and discipline employers, to allow the laborers what they want, and to coerce payment of higher wages by employers using the weapon of strikes. Well, he nailed it on the head, exactly what they were doing. He argues from what both what he calls moral and economic results of organized labor and what it actually did to families and what it actually did to the economy in places where labor unions were dominant. He said that if they go on strike, the employer will get on okay. The workers will become destitute. Scabs pick up the slack, and union workers suffer. I mean, his argument was for union workers to read and to understand, they are the ones who are going to suffer for belonging to a labor union. He said, labor unions quickly sink into criminal behavior, violence, illegal violence. He said, labor unions become criminal conspiracies. Now, he was in a place where there weren't any labor unions. At this time, he was teaching philosophy. He started the philosophy department at the University of Texas. That's where he was, I believe, when he wrote this particular essay. And by that time, too, he was blind. And so his daughter would sit and read to him, and she read the newspapers to him. And he would analyze what he was hearing and dictate back these essays on current events, you might say, and current institutions like organized labor. He says they bash the monopolies and trusts, yet they themselves form monopolies of labor. He said, and when political demagogues adopt the cause of labor unions to cater for their votes, boy, I'm glad they don't do that anymore, huh? Under the pretense of democracy, they're doing the most undemocratic thing possible. For the masses against the classes, yet they are assisting a narrow class to plunder the masses of their fellow citizens. Has he been reading yesterday's paper? Has he been reading what goes on in front of a presidential election in modern times? He saw this going on in 1890. Well, 100 years later, that's part and parcel of American politics. But he saw it happening, and he issues the warning. Union members yourself, all you're going to do is subsidize labor bosses who are going to sell your soul to the politician who will give them the most under the table. That's what happens. Exactly right. He said they have a groundless and impudent claim that they are contending for the, quote, rights of American labor as if they are the only ones who labor. They are a tiny percentage. See, labor unions were getting a lot of press. And he was saying, most Americans are farmers. And they don't have a labor union. And they're able to survive. And he's wistful in many ways for the antebellum South, for the old world that was destroyed in 1865. And being a farmer himself and loving farming and farmers, he was always contrasting big city organized labor political bosses with the men who were toiling in the fields, the people that were producing on the farms. And some of that comes into his argument against labor unions. Contrasting the agrarian lifestyle to what was happening in the big cities. Dabney quoted Rutherford's Lex Rex on a number of occasions, and he also talked about communism, and he talked about how labor unions and the commune have certain presuppositions in common. Very insightful writing on a problem of the period. Well, let me close with just a few quotes from Dabney on another subject. This was the one I figured would probably get me in the most trouble. Saved it for last, and now we're going to run out of time, and I'm not going to get to read it all. But one of his most famous social, secular essays, nothing secular about it, is entitled Women's Rights, Women. Here it is. I'm just going to read to you the first two paragraphs. That may be all we have time left for, but it'll give you an idea. Also, I recommend this entire article to you. You, I think, would enjoy it. And we see his wit and his irascible self coming out in this essay. In our day, think about this. Think of the wisdom of these words. In our day, innovations march with so rapid a stride that they quite take one's breath. The fantastical project of yesterday, which was mentioned only to be ridiculed, is today the audacious reform and will be tomorrow the accomplished fact. Such has been the history of the agitation for women's rights, as they are sophistically called in this country. A few years ago, this movement was the especial hobby of a few old women of both sexes, who made themselves the laughingstock of all sane people by the annual ventilation of their crotchet. Their only recruits were a few of the unfortunates whom nature or fortune had debarred from those triumphs and enjoyments which are the natural ambition of the sex, and who adopted this agitation as the most feasible mode of expressing their spitefulness against the successful competitors. What he's saying there is the women's rights women are ugly, mean women who couldn't get a husband. That's the West Virginia translation, okay? Today, the movement has assumed such dimensions that it challenges the attention of every thoughtful mind. If we understand the claims of the women's rights women, they are in substance two: that the legislation, at least of society, shall regard all the natural distinctions of the sexes and award the same specific rights and franchises to both in every respect, and that women, while in the married state, shall be released from every species of conjugal subordination. The assimilation of the garments of the two sexes, that is, men and women dressing alike, their competition in the same industries and professions, and their common access to the same amusements and recreations, are social changes which are, quote, strong-minded, expect to work, each one for herself. Then once the obstructions of law are removed from other points. And he goes on and on about women's rights, women. And just one more quote there, because this article is full of scripture as well. He quotes quite a bit of the New Testament content regarding the marriage relationship, because he saw what today we call radical feminism, which in some ways is redundant, but in his day, he saw what they were advocating, what they wanted. Now, in our day, they have achieved all of the things that they were agitating for in his day. And if you read about the leaders of that movement in his day, you would realize what moral reprobates they were and how destructive of marriage their policies would become. He says women's rights is sheer infidelity. Let me see. He's got let's see if I can find his comment on what he... here we are. Now then, when Mistress Amazona Narragansett steps forward, he's calling them Amazons, and having vindicated her claim to have belonged always to the true Israel of the unconditional unionists, demands a simple and obvious application of these honored maxims to her own case, how can she be gainsaid? Hitherto, the state has governed her without asking her consent at the ballot box. This is self-evidently against the immortal truth that all just government is founded on the consent of the governed. And he goes on to explain what the Founding Fathers meant by each of the relevant phrases on political equality as it's being interpreted in his day, what the Founding Fathers intended for it. So the article itself is a tremendous commentary on the Founding Fathers and the Constitution, but it's also a biblical analysis of the differences between men and women and their relationship in marriage and in the home. And I recommend it to you. And you can see he didn't pull any punches when he went on and on about women, women's rights, women. Today, as we would say, the feminists. And their agendas, as you read this, not only have they all been fulfilled, but they've gone so far beyond what he predicted. In fact, he actually predicted some pretty awful stuff, and now it's standard. And Robert Louis Dabney would not be surprised at homosexual marriage advocacy. He would not be surprised at the persecution of Christians who disagree with the current political correctness. He would have said, that's exactly what Scripture says will happen when you get away from the God of Scriptures